Okay, we are back. Welcome to another episode of Just Another Bozo on the Bus. So welcome, bozos, which now I thought I should start calling the listeners bozos. They felt included into this program. For those of you, I'm drinking decaf coffee, which it's all I've been drinking since my heart attack, and I just got the best cup of coffee that was brought to me by my dear friend, Lisa Bridge, who's joining us today. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Paul, it's a pleasure to be here finally after rescheduling. And
we did reschedule a number of times.
Yeah. Well, we're good excuse. I'm glad you're doing well.
Oh, true. Once was when I had a heart attack, I think. Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm glad we finally got this rescheduled. And as I was telling Lisa before we started today, that I started running a couple of weeks ago, which has been an interesting experience. I'm not running long distances, but I'm running enough that I'm getting my heart rate up, which I'm supposed to keep under 130, even when I'm exercising at this point. And it's been going well. I'm up to, I know this doesn't sound like a lot, but I'm up to about a mile and a half. And my goal is to get up to 5. Miles.
He's looking really good, people. He's looking well, so he's not as pasty white as
I
climb.
Not as pasty white as I have been. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Lisa. So, again, part of the purpose of this podcast is to have you spend some time and allow people to get to know you. And we do that by you telling your story, however you feel fit to do it. Yeah, I've known you, oh my gosh, I was thinking 3.5 years, I think, we've known each other. And it's been an amazing journey over those 3.5 years. And but your story and kind of what brought you and got you to this place is also an incredible story, too. So wherever you would like to start and let people kind of know what your life story is a little bit about.
Sure. It is an amazing story, and I'm very grateful that you're a part of it, and so thankful for all of your help and insight and the education that you've helped me with, because that's a strong foundation of my recovery today.
You mean so I didn't mess everything up? Is that?
No, you reinforced a lot of things for me, and what others held for me is to what in my heart I already knew. So thank you. Like many, I started drinking when I was 13. My past as a child was difficult. Difficulties with specifically my mom. I think a lot of that stemmed from trying to do everything to please her, and I carried that on into my adult life. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of leaping forward. But what brought me to Wasatch finally was on my own reaching out for help. In the past, I did it for others.
Mm-hmm. You were a good caretaker. Yes.
I think we need to give we need to give him caffeine in his coffee today. So yes, from a young age, from about 9 or 10 years old, I learned to take care of people and continue to do that for most of my life. And that was a pattern of behavior that I learned very well, and with my own family, and learned that not only did I do it well, I learned not to focus on myself. The more I focused on other people, the more I didn't have to look at my own issues.
Sure. And one of the first people that you found yourself trained or learned to take care of was your mom, right? I mean, she was sort of your I mean, if I use the term parentification, that where sometimes roles get changed, right? So, what was that experience like for you? And I know a lot of adults relate to this, finding themselves either taking care of their younger children in the family, or they find themselves taking care of a parent.
Right. It was
at a very young age.
At a very young age. So when you're a child, you want to please your parents, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get that little pat on the head, but that never came. And so the more I tried, I tried to not only excel, but do exceedingly well, mm-hmm. and do exceedingly well at everything. If you told me to do something, I tried to do it better than everyone else, and that pattern of behavior continued throughout my life. And I tried to please everyone just to get that acceptance and validation. So that's where it began, was with my mom.
Yeah. Do you think that was maybe also the beginning of some leaning towards perfectionism a little bit in your life?
Absolutely.
So you noticed that too. When you look back and you think of what it was like when these roles began to change, I'm going to guess this felt kind of natural in some way too.
Until I got to be a teenager.
And
your peers started to point out how wrong that was to them.
What do you mean they pointed that out?
As you grow up into, trying to go out with friends and do things with them, and mm-hmm. even as a young child, I'm talking maybe 12 or 13, and mm-hmm. wanting to go participate with them.
Yeah.
And so my childhood friends were in the Mormon church. Mm-hmm. We weren't active LDS, but there were mutual programs to what they want me to participate in.
Sure.
And I wouldn't be allowed to go and do things with them unless this and this and this and this were done. Or I had responsibilities at home where not only was the house to be cleaned, dinner was to be cooked and on the table and then cleaned up afterwards, and then I had my school responsibilities.
So are you saying you were responsible for the cooking, the cleaning, and the cleanup after dinner as well?
Yes.
Okay.
And so not being able to participate in after-school activities or mutual activities, mm-hmm. and we're talking not going to church activities, but we're talking basketball,
sure.
and camps and things.
All the extracurricular stuff.
And so children my own age or preteens or teenagers are pointing out to me that that seemed wrong to them.
Yeah.
And so then I started lashing out. And that behavior included drinking. And then when I started drinking, I realized that I started feeling better,
mm-hmm.
and those feelings started going away.
So that you said you started drinking when you were 13, so that's early adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
You were already, you were already had some friends, I'm making the assumption, even though your life was really wrapped around taking care of the home as much as you were,
mm-hmm.
For a young adolescent. How did the drinking start? What did was someone in the house already drinking? Was mom already drinking?
What was the
accessibility?
So it was a babysitter.
Oh.
It was a job that I was babysitting at.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did not know this at the time, but the woman that I babysat for was an alcoholic, and there was alcohol all over the house.
Oh.
And so it was kind of on a dare that we tried it. It was me and my next door neighbor, my girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
And so I started stealing alcohol from her and hiding it in my bedroom.
Well, and if she was an alcoholic, I mean, there's two types of alcoholics. Ones that know how much they drink and how much they have, and others that just don't give a shit.
Oh, she wouldn't have missed it. I mean, there was alcohol. There was gallons of vodka in the laundry basket. And she loved having me over because of my perfectionist tendencies. I would clean her house and watch her kids and steal her vodka. So.
Fascinating trait.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but my babysitting days soon ended after, they'd come home and found me passed out on the floor.
Oh, well, that would change things.
That would.
Did at this point, did they contact the home front for you? Or did they...
I don't remember what happened, but I don't think they did. I ended up home in my next bed, or in my bed the next morning, mm-hmm. and I don't remember what happened.
Oh. Okay.
And that's...
So you had... That was... So is this still 13? How old were you?
Oh, it was probably 16, 17. 16. This went on for several years.
Okay, so you were doing this for several years. And I'm guessing or wondering that this probably wasn't the first time you had a blackout, right?
No.
Okay.
No. I was continuing to pull straight A's, do my responsibilities at home, and there was a anger inside of me. As I look back on this, because I still had two older brothers at home that mm-hmm. were from my mother's first marriage, who had no responsibilities at home, and I was still expected to pull this load mm-hmm. at home, and still trying to prove to not only to myself but to my mom that I was worthy.
Mm-hmm. Where's Dad during this time?
Dad's traveling. Quite a bit. He's a soft lens salesman for Ciba or Bausch & Lomb, which is primarily on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. So he's gone Monday through Friday. And Mom primarily worked swing shift at the time at Fred Meyer. Mm. And so I was not doing very nice things. I was stealing her car out of the parking lot at Fred Meyer. And, I was a rebel.
I'm going to guess that probably some of that was just learned behavior based upon what you needed to do to take care of yourself at the time. And, you know, because for whatever reason, you didn't have really good boundaries at home either, except, you had been well trained to, you know, be sort of a domestic almost, you know.
Absolutely.
I remember your mom, she'd come home and would like to hide out in the... She was a room. She liked to come home and venture into a room and stay there.
She would, or she would take a book and she'd lay down on the floor and read, and I'd vacuum around her and dust around her. And mm-hmm.
Was she using anything at this time?
Yeah, she hadn't met Ray. Ray was the one that was the drug dealer. And she had had an affair with him when I was 10, and she may have seen him off and on until my parents divorced when I was 17, mm-hmm. and I think that's probably when that started back up again.
Okay.
So she would isolate in her room, and I would bring her coffee in the morning, and then she'd finally get out of bed and go to work.
Oh, my.
So.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think my acting out was part of getting attention, mm-hmm. not from, I mean, probably from her, but mostly from other people, from friends, mm-hmm. and maybe attracting the wrong friends, but bringing about a different part of my personality rather than that domesticated mm-hmm. side, mm-hmm. because that's not who I wanted to be. Excuse me.
Yeah, so you didn't want to be the person that was having to be responsible for all the domestic issues at home, but it sounds like.
Well, those friends that told me that behavior was wrong, I couldn't rebel against my parents because I clearly remember telling my dad I felt that this was wrong, and I still remember to this day sitting on the front steps with my dad telling him how I felt and him telling me to get off the piss pot and quit whining. Mm-hmm. So from a really young age, I didn't have a voice.
Well, in some ways, though, you were keeping the peace in the household because he was gone most of the time. So as long as you were covering everything, it gave him cover, too.
Well, and he did not like conflict.
he was a peacemaker, and you were the one that was the glue holding everything together at home, which just, you know, he didn't want to mess up that cart because then everything would be coming towards him.
Yes.
Yeah. So, what was the relation like between your mom and your dad?
You know, up until the time they divorced, I, and according to everyone else around them, thought everything was fine. There was no vocal outburst. There was no arguing, even to my knowledge, behind closed doors. Huh. And so when the divorce happened, when everything blew apart, it was a shock. It really was. My dad is a very quiet, gentle person. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know what was happening to him inside. until I fully understood later.
He wasn't talking to you about those things at that time.
No.
So, and understandably so.
Yeah.
So they get divorced. What happens? Does he move out or?
He at that time I was pregnant with my daughter.
Oh, okay.
And so I had moved out for a month because of the chaos that was going on between my mom and dad mm-hmm. and the divorce. I had found out I was pregnant, hadn't told my parents. I'd moved in with a girlfriend. Mom had moved in with her mom out in Draper, my grandma Myers. My brother was on leave from the army, came home to find my dad at the house. And didn't know this was going on between my parents. He told Mark that he was going to San Francisco with a woman that he met in North Carolina, who is now my mom, Candace.
Okay.
Mark was upset, understandably, because he'd been out of, he'd been in Texas at this time. I felt very manipulated. My mom used me as a sounding board for all of her hurt, all of her feelings. I witnessed, they'd been married for 18 years. My mom, I don't know, I know my mom loved him very much, but mm-hmm. She even admitted to me that she didn't treat my father very well, mm-hmm. But she was hurt and she was distraught and she lashed out her anger and her frustration, her fear, her hurt, all of that I was there for. Mm-hmm. And so my feelings toward my dad at that time when I was 17 and I became very angry at my dad. And so I supported my mom at that time the best that I could when I came back home, told mm-hmm. my parents that I was pregnant. My dad tried to, he went to San Francisco. When he came back, he tried to gain entry into the house. My mom had changed the locks. It was all a very chaotic time. My mom refused to let him in. And so after my daughter was born, I continued to drink. I would get
angry. Were you drinking while you were pregnant?
No.
Okay.
But I would get drunk and call my dad hurtful, awful names, lash out at him for leaving me.
He became a sounding board like you would become one for your mom a little bit, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
So there was some correlation there. I'm curious that during this time, did your you being the one that had taken care of everything and had been running everything for so long and sort of keeping the peace and then this sort of change happened and then the divorce comes along. What did you end up finding yourself in those moments turning to? I mean, was it just alcohol? But did you have any friend base? Did you have any connection with people outside of that? And or what about the father of your?
So I ended up getting married when I was 8 months pregnant. The friends that we had are still some of the friends that we have today, but it was a lot of parties, a lot of chaos mm-hmm. at the time. We lived with my mom from February of 1982 until that November.
you and your husband and the
yes.
baby.
And then I was still taking care of my mom. My mom was crippled emotionally and physically. She didn't know how to take care of herself. My dad had always done that for her. Mm-hmm. I had always done that for her. And so by my dad leaving her, it was, in my opinion, one of the best things that happened to her, mm-hmm. because she had to learn.
She had to learn to take care of herself.
Right.
And you weren't, you had stopped doing that.
Well, I had to take care of my own family now,
yeah, right?
Yeah. But I wasn't drinking daily at the time. I was drinking maybe on the weekends, and okay. that would be when I would get my feelings for my dad, because my dad and I were really close when I was little.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the time, and then I'd get drunk and I'd call him. That'd be the only time I would call him. And right. bless his heart, he listened.
That's pretty remarkable when you think about it.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That he would sit and listen and just allow you to vent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And you and I have talked about my longing for what is a family to me. And the reasons why, you know, my marriage, even though it lasted for 16 years and had its rough spots, why I stayed and why I have three beautiful kids and, you know, the longing for family, mm-hmm. my own family and somebody to love.
Sure. Now, I relate to this story because I did the same thing. I created a family.
Yeah.
I created a community because... I felt like I didn't really have one growing up in a much different way. And, I mean, my responsibilities were not like yours, and I wasn't expected to provide care to any younger siblings, being the youngest. But I understand that feeling of wanting to have connection, and family seemed like the way to do it. I was going to ask you this question, too, that was it almost like the idea of you know, becoming pregnant and even before you decided to get married, mm-hmm. you know, that if that was in a way a catalyst that maybe subconsciously, or maybe you knew it, you know, maybe you had awareness of it, that this was something that was going to differentiate you from your mother.
Yes.
You did know, you did yes. have that. Okay. Yeah.
It so was you, almost in defiance.
Yeah.
And it was like with everything that I was at the time, it was going to be different.
Uh-huh.
I would not raise my kids like my mother.
Okay.
There was no way in hell. And even in my darkest days of abuse, substance abuse, mm-hmm. even my kids will recount me saying, I do not want to be like my mother.
Yeah.
And I do not recall saying that. But that's how deep-seated that
sure,
is.
Sure, it was. You were verbalizing it or making people aware of it regardless. No, I understand. I get this, that we do that, whether that some of those subconscious, deep-rooted schemas, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
that we have begin to become acted out and they take on a life of their own and the people around us begin to hear them,
mm-hmm.
and it's interesting that you don't remember doing it, but your kids remember hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to be like my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to guess on some level. Well, these are the two funny parts, right? And,
yes.
And I think everyone says that about their parents.
You're
at
right.
some level. And then we end up, some of us turn into, or the majority of us, end up turning into something like our parents do. So not always the one that we had the most trouble with, but we kind of go through and find our way and navigate through this. Because it's not like... You know, some of this stuff doesn't get imprinted upon us and become some schemas that are running underneath our awareness just because we were around it for so long. Yeah.
But that's the best part.
Okay.
Is when she said to me, you're just like your father.
Yeah. And I'm going to guess you're talking about your mom?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like a good moment, actually.
It
yeah.
was. Okay. It was. Yeah. But... in the same vein, I don't think I did my children any favors when I raised them and treated them without the responsibilities at least a little bit with what I had, because sure. I went the other way.
Sure.
In saying, I will not be like my mother. Mm-hmm. I will do everything for you. I will jump over every mountain for you. And so that began the enmeshment, you yeah. know, the relationship that I had with my kids and giving them everything. And, you know,
you became a powerful fixer.
I did. I will fix everything for you. Yeah.
Here I am to save the day.
Yes, I will be your hero. But, you know, I'm very blessed with, you know, the kids that I have and the amends that I've been able to make with them. But with my father, you know, that calling him up and lashing out at him went on for 13 years.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah, because it took me that cycling and being in addiction and finally getting help took 13 years. Mm-hmm. And to process that grief and that anger and that relationship with my mom and being finally aware of how toxic that was mm-hmm. took until then, and then being finally able to realize that my dad did not divorce me.
Right.
You know? And so,
what a beautiful awareness to have.
Yeah.
That actually, even though, and a lot of this is probably rage coming out from, you know, all the disconnection and lack of feeling bonded with your parents to begin with. Dad being gone so much of the time, mom, you know, having reverse roles with you in the household. It would be kind of normal to do that. For what did you not lash out on your mom the same way? Or did you lash out to her too? Or was that not a viable resource? Was it just mainly that your dad got all this emotional reaction? And was that partly because he was safe to do it with?
Dad was safe.
Okay.
Mom was like anticlimactic. Never. I was able to process that at Wasatch.
Mm-hmm.
Mom and I haven't spoke for 17 years. She's in Oregon with her two sons, my two stepbrothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to a very good place with respect to where I'm at with the relationship that I have.
Mm-hmm.
But that it took a long time. And the best thing that I can say about people that have relationships like that with parents or siblings is it's not personal.
Right.
And
it's not about us.
It's not about us.
Right.
My mom did the best she could mm-hmm. with what she knew.
Right.
All of us have core belief systems that were set upon us.
Mm-hmm.
My mom, I did everything that I could for her even after my divorce and tried to continue that role and couldn't. My family was my priority, and I tried to make adjustments mm-hmm. that still allowed that to happen, and those weren't acceptable to my mom, and she slammed the phone down back in 2001,
mm-hmm.
and that's the last time I heard from her. My brother lashed out at me saying that I was selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very straightforward in my response, saying that he's been out of the country, he's been with the army, mm-hmm. he's not been here, he doesn't understand what I've been dealing with. So really, he had no place to call me selfish.
Mm-hmm.
You live with her, then you call me back. 2 years later, he apologized.
Sorry. But yeah, but it is. And now you know the whole story.
You know.
Page two.
So
the rest of the story came out, and then he called and apologized. And what was that like? I mean, I'm assuming he did this from a humble place of some kind.
Well, there's always a but.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
But she's your mother.
Oh, okay.
And I processed that too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in recovery, and even if you're very strong in your recovery,
mm-hmm.
my personal thought or my feeling is, if that's toxic for you,
mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem leaving that door shut.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I know what's behind that door.
Right. No, this is the whole. This is the whole identification of what healthy boundaries are,
mm-hmm.
and the risks associated with one, you know, starting to maintain and develop those healthy boundaries, and the other one is what happens if I don't. You know, what does that look like? And so, sometimes the idea of having a healthy boundary, which sometimes means literally closing a door,
mm-hmm.
and moving on. Can look very abrupt or very, what word am I thinking of here? But seem like the ultimate or the most destructive way to stop or end something. But the truth of the matter is, it's actually a call for independence and differentiation, where we're able to go off and do something for ourselves and not have to pull the past or the drama or the dysfunction of the past with us. And that can seem scary too. I mean, once people are, you know, being, you can grow up in a very dysfunctional environment. And I've just, you know, we deal with this all the time from a family system. Being a marriage and family therapist, I look at so much from the systemic model that I see that sometimes families just want to go back to that dysfunction no matter what. And the problem with that is that in the long run, if they want to maintain a certain level of homeostasis, and it's a very dysfunctional one, it ends up perpetuating through that family and then through the next generation of the family and so on and so forth. It has to stop at some point.
It does.
And so even though it may seem harsh or it may seem have a finality to it, you closing that door allowed you to move on and then, you know, bring some things to your family and bring some dynamics, you know, healthier dynamics to that. And I know this story unfolds as it goes through, and you talk about the journey of your kids, but there's definitely a different scenario there. Even with all the issues and the problems you have, your kids are much different than the children of you, the child of your parents, too.
Absolutely.
So, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But I, to your point, you know, if you're in recovery and you don't have a good foundation with your reserves and you're taking care of yourself, you constantly stir up that chaos. You willingly open those doors.
Yeah.
And I'm not in a position to do that. And as long as I take care of my recovery on a daily basis, that door remains closed.
Yeah.
All of those doors.
Yeah.
It's like a reserve account. And I just make sure that every day I do those checks. And it's a gut check. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a reserve account, and has to do with your spirituality, your mental, your physical health, and your honesty, your integrity, and every single one of those things,
yes,
has to click every day.
Yeah, of course. You kind of talked a little bit, and you're talking about this sort of this transition that you went through. But what were the points when you and your husband were divorced? What were the things? Was it the drinking was part of it, or what were the factors, do you think, that led to the breakup between the two of you?
Well, there were two primary things. One was there was the jealousy. He was jealous of my success. I was very driven because of the perfectionism.
Sure, yeah.
Trying to prove myself.
You were locked and loaded, ready to go on with your life and be and do something, which you did, of course.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed what I did, but I was still set on that path to prove myself, mm-hmm. to no matter who it was. I still was seeking that validation, mm-hmm. and that was a pattern all my life. But at the same time, I still loved what I did. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that I wasn't enjoying the path.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to let our listeners know what you were doing at this point?
I was working at Smith's corporate office, and I had started out there as a legal secretary. Mm-hmm. And by the time I left, I was the director of real estate, building multi-million-dollar projects, acquiring and negotiating land contracts, building fuel centers in Utah, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and Arizona. I had built numerous stores and fuel centers, and it was going endless hours every day.
Sure.
And
so, besides being an alcoholic, are you saying you were a workaholic too?
Yeah,
because I relate to that one as well, of course.
Yeah, but it was.
No, I've changed.
It was. It was. Yes, yes, you had to. You know, it's either a heart attack or
you're right, right.
Yeah,
yeah, you're right. Either make some changes here.
Yeah, but it was. I wasn't blind to the fact of the pattern of behavior that had established itself along the way, and that was the adrenaline rush that I got from projects that were so stressful. And I'd get a store open, and once the grand opening happened and the rush was gone, mm-hmm. I'd relapse.
Fascinating.
Yeah. I needed something to replace that.
Yeah.
And you know, I'd had 8 years of sobriety and was working on a Smith's first marketplace store from the ground up, and finally got that store open. And once it was open, I crashed and burned.
Hmm.
So that was a behavior pattern for a number of years after that relapse.
So driven so hard and being to just immerse yourself into these projects, mm-hmm. carried them all the way through to the finish line, and then crash.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And your go-to was alcohol.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I'd pull myself out of it and find myself something to bury myself into and go at it again. And I think...
Bit of a destructive pattern,
yeah.
to say the least, yeah.
I think the what I wasn't exploring and what I wasn't looking at was being alone.
Mm-hmm.
My kids were gone. The last one left home. I'd put them through college. He left home to live with his dad. Couldn't put up with me anymore. We had gone on a family vacation to Disneyland. My son flew home from Australia, and there was some discontent with him. He wasn't happy at the time. I think he was a little bit worried about his job at the time, but we had reminisced a lot that trip in Disneyland. Had taken a walk with him, had touched something deep inside, realizing that I hadn't really processed him leaving the first time. But that kind of that empty nest syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely a change.
And then coming back from Disneyland, this was in January, and then followed up on another major trip to Vegas on a major store acquisition, went on like a 2-week bender, and then ended it. That's when I came to Wasatch.
Was the bender in Vegas, or was it at home?
Started in Vegas.
Started in Vegas.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then disappeared from work for 10 days and called a cab and went up to uni. So.
And the rest is history.
The rest, it is.
What an adventure when you look back and sort of recap this in such a way to kind of examine through this. What a journey this has been. I mean, today is so much different than that day walking into the uni compared to that moment, you know, where did you feel the surrender that day, though, that first day? Did you feel it when you walked in there? I'm curious.
I don't remember.
You don't remember.
I don't remember. I only remember the thought that I knew I was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I was that bad.
Okay.
Uh-huh. This cycle of every day trying to get to get more alcohol because I had such bad DTs. Mm-hmm. I mean, physically, I could not stop drinking.
Sure, you had to maintain a certain level of alcohol in you to maintain a state of homeostasis so that you didn't get sick or didn't go into withdrawal. So it was actually the only thing that was at that point probably keeping you alive, because if you did detox, you'd probably seizure at that point.
Oh, I had alcohol. I mean, I was paralyzed after I got to uni. And when I came to Wasatch, and so that was, I'm just extremely grateful for the health that I have today. You know, regardless of what happens in your past, you have to forgive yourself of that. And, you know, where you've been to get where you're at. Because you have a choice between living and dying.
Mm-hmm.
You really do. Because that's what it'll eventually come to. I think everybody who ever starts on the path of destruction, of addiction, realizes at some point, and I think mine came at 17 years old, this doesn't end well.
Mm-mm. No.
And at that young age, you're like, oh, it'll never happen to me.
Right. Well, I'm invincible at that point,
right.
too. You know, what's the worst that can happen, too, you know? So, and understanding that from 17-year-olds, which is late adolescent still, you know, the world seems pretty simple in some ways, you know. It's either this way or that way. I mean, and the direction I go. And it's a lot different as an adult. I mean, we sort of understand the way that we disperse energy has to be, we have to place values and importance and, you know, prioritize things in different ways and make choices that where our self-care comes into effect, too. And how well do we balance that? There's so many other factors that, you know, someone in their adolescent years doesn't quite comprehend or doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah.
Self-care?
Yes, self-care. Okay, we have a good laugh about that one, right? Okay, yes, self-care.
So, family and getting out of Wasatch. I entered Wasatch March of 2015, and then left in June, found out I was fired, and continued with IOP until November, and then went into aftercare, and been 3 years, three, March, April, May, June, July, 3 years, 5 months in recovery.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you.
Congratulations. And you and I have talked about the importance of aftercare a lot, and this idea that how, you know, developing connection and community and learning to be with a group of people that you can be vulnerable with and sort of seeing what it feels like to develop a level of intimacy that, you know, most of our relationships don't get to to fall into, or don't to get to be, well, fall into is not the best way to put that. But most of our relationships don't have that, those kind of qualities with them. They don't have the vulnerability and the intimacy associated with it. But I do see in aftercare that that's a place where that can happen, where you can get to know people really well and learn to be vulnerable and be open-hearted, or wholehearted is the term I use, you know, a lot, that this idea of how do I learn to be a wholehearted human being? And I think for people that are in recovery or experiencing any type of disconnection in their lives, or have bonded with unhealthy behaviors, whether it be a substance, work, sex, food, money, whatever. Right. Yeah.
Well, it's that old saying in AA, our stories fall along similar lines.
Yes.
And yeah, in that group of people, nothing could be truer, right?
Exactly.
And so there's such empathy surrounding that group.
Yeah.
But once you get, you know, if you're in resident, inpatient, your mind changes so rapidly after you quit using, mm-hmm, right? That it takes a long time before you really start getting a handle on recovery. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, recovery is an educational process. Everybody should learn as much as they can about addiction.
Yes.
Not just, I mean, it's the simplest part is getting off the drug, right?
Yes.
But the most important part is learning, the education part. Yeah. I mean, the science part and the family education part is critical.
Yeah.
Because the more you understand it, the more you understand about what is happening to you.
Right.
As you go along, it's like, oh, that's what he meant when he said that. That's what they meant when they were talking about it in group.
Sure.
Because you don't think it applies to you until maybe 6 months or a year down the road.
Right. Right.
And so when you're in group and they're sharing these stories, if you listen close enough, it applies to you at some point in the future.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. I mean, we're so much, we're always more alike than we are different. Even though sometimes we all like to focus on the differences, the truth of the matter is we have so much in common.
Absolutely.
And especially when I think of, you know, and you already know this, and I think of addiction as a human condition, something everyone will experience in some form or another, even if it's just an obsession or a compulsion towards a behavior or an idea or a belief system, whether, I mean, it could be, you know, some form of religiosity that people can become, you know, addicted to a belief system, and it takes over their life to the point that they can't see anything but that. And then they judge everyone based upon that. That's the same. I don't see any difference between that and seeing the world through the idea of, opium or alcohol or anything along those lines.
Absolutely. Yeah. I truly believe, I mean, I've been through three outpatient programs and then the residential program. Mm-hmm. But even the first outpatient program taught me to be a more empathetic, kinder, mm-hmm, wholehearted person. And applying it throughout your life enriches a person's spiritual soul, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I often joked with one of the people at House One over at Wasatch,
mm-hmm,
everyone should be required to go through recovery.
Yeah, right, right.
It would be a more kinder, gentler world if they did.
Well, because you focus on the commonalities instead of the differences, and you're right, and especially in times where, you know, divisions and tribalism and things become more polarized, it is true. It would be nice to have everyone come from a place of accountability and definitely move beyond one of the most important tools that comes out of all this is the victim stance, you know, this the victim narrative, the story that we have about why, you know, we can't take responsibility for our beliefs, our thoughts, our feelings, our behaviors, why we need to project them onto somebody else, when really our happiness and our truth and all come down to you know, being able to take accountability, to accept responsibility, is coming from a place of acceptance and learning to forgive ourselves for our choices. Forgiveness becomes such a huge part of recovery. And again, I'll even take the word recovery out. Personal healing, you know, the foundation of becoming wholehearted is this idea of learning to forgive ourselves, because the common denominator is we're all still battling shame. You know, and that's sort of that, along with, you know, perfectionism. Oh. Shame is the fuel. Shame fuels perfectionism, by the way, just like addiction. Boy, are they correlated. And, of course, I think I used to, what did I say? It's not being a perfectionist, it's being an imperfectionist, because we see all the problems or what things aren't perfect around us, and we want to make them different instead of learning to accept life as it is. Right?
But if I'm perfect, then that's nobody can see me for who I really am.
Yes! Right? I love that from the aspect of insanity, because the belief is, the insanity part of that is, I believe if I look a certain way, people won't really see what's going on.
Right.
Yeah. That's the masks. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, well, we're gonna move on a little bit here and discuss a couple of theirs. One of the things that I ask a number of people to come on the show, and we did touch upon a number of them, these things already, being the fixer and the saboteur. So when you're going through these different dynamics in your life, talk about some dichotomies happening. You grew up learning to be a fixer. You were taught to be a fixer, right? Take care of all the problems. Make everything better. Make sure everything's okay, you know? Be responsible for everybody, practically. And somewhere along the way, hearing your story kind of laid out, you know, in a linear fashion today, that there was some point where you went, I think it's time to start sabotaging a few things in there. Do you see those parallels?
Oh, absolutely.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. So it's fun today to be able to still have some of those behaviors and then go. And I'm roughing up everything right now. You can't see this,
right.
So it's just
like, about that, because we figure someone may be watching us. We go, so right now we're doing this.
So it's fun to have a sense of humor about it today and be able to laugh at myself.
So important. The bozo on the bus. Exactly what, you know, this whole podcast is about, is learning to accept our bozo-ness, right?
Yeah. So I still have, you can't get rid of some of those traits, because those patterns, I mean, I'll be 55 this year. Mm-hmm. And so I still have a lot of those same traits, because I've done them over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Still have to have things a certain way.
Gotcha.
And so, but I can still go back and mess it up and laugh, right?
Uh-huh.
So, and I've passed a lot of those on to my children, namely my oldest. And it was heartbreaking for me to realize when I got out of Wasatch, to realize she was, addicted to opioids, and how blind I'd been and wrapped up in my own addiction, that, to realize that, she, through her, she's got Crohn's, had been diagnosed when she was 15, and had been using opioids for pain control, and I don't know how long she's been addicted to opioids, but
for a long time.
Yeah. And had been manipulating her doctors, and
well, her brain, I mean, this story is, I mean, we've heard it so many times, right?
Right.
Of, you know, starting narcotics or, you know, or painkillers or opiates for pain management. And that really, in the long run, they're probably one of the worst things that can be used for pain management, because they actually don't manage pain. They mask it. And the baseline eventually goes away. The brain gets rewired through the opiates over, you know, I mean, for some people it can be as soon as 6 months, but when you start adding on years of opiate dependence, it changes and rewires so much that the possibility of really knowing what's pain anymore or not is almost impossible.
So going back to what I said about education, mm-hmm. I knew that from you mm-hmm. and watching her. Mm-hmm. And so having some knowledge toward what she was going through and maybe what we were headed for, because I knew handling her issues were going to be, or trying to help her with her issues was going to be a challenge because of her chronic illness. Mm-hmm. And so I had a wonderful support group because I was still attending IOP, and from IOP to aftercare, I was there almost every group processing my feelings, mm-hmm. processing the hurt, processing the struggle, and trying to understand how I could get some help for my daughter. Mm-hmm. And coming to the realization, as we all do, that she wasn't going to get help until she was ready to help herself. But the dynamic of our relationship in our family was what became fascinating to me, and what I was able to share a few weeks ago in our aftercare group was mm-hmm. I look at the lineage between my mother and myself and how I parented her mm-hmm. when I was a child. Mm-hmm. And how my daughter parented me mm-hmm. in my addiction, mm-hmm. and how her son, Caden, has parented her through her addiction.
So you saw this multi-generational pattern.
Right.
That has existed probably even before you were born, probably within your family system.
Right.
Be played out again. Some of this we talked about, so how some of these schemas, we're not even aware of them, begin to, you know, unfold and repeat themselves. Mm-hmm. And so to see this example happen with your daughter and then with your grandson, sort of some of these role, the way that these roles played out again.
Right. And my grandson, he's 13. And so he's been a caretaker for my daughter. And how witnessing that, like I'm standing on the outside looking in,
sure. It's
just one of those holy shit moments, yeah. You know, and it's like, oh my God, what have I done? And it's not, I mean, that was your initial knee-jerk reaction,
right.
And you want to reach out and strangle your child going, do you realize what you're doing?
Right.
Yeah. And what have you done? And you got to quit doing this. And he's too young to be parenting you, and he's got to stop this.
Right.
And yeah.
And oh, by the way, I passed this on.
This is all my fault.
No,
and
it's not.
It stops now.
You were doing what you were taught. This is the weird part, is we're taught this, and then we teach other people.
Right.
This is how family cycles continue to work. So he's learned to be, where we started talking about this is the idea that he's learned to be a fixer, mm-hmm. right? And so I guess the question would come up is eventually will the pendulum swing the other way, and will he have to create some sabotage in such a way to differentiate and move away from that role? It doesn't have to happen. You understand what I mean?
If you look at
your family and you look at your kids, that it hasn't been the same dynamic. Yes, some of this got passed on with your oldest,
mm-hmm.
okay? But that's not the story all the way through.
Right.
And so there's a chance here to, you know, he doesn't have to become a full-on Monty. I can't believe I just said that, but the full-on Monty of saboteurism is where I'm going with that.
Right.
You know, it sounded funny in my head. But again, what sounds funny in my head, I've been told, is not always really funny.
You ought to see the picture in my head.
Yeah,
no.
You're welcome. Sorry. Okay, you're welcome, and I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. Right. So as we talked about in group, it was always my hope to get her help and to, you know, for her to get into treatment but that's where it stopped, mm-hmm. right? And so she eventually called me and said, I'm in trouble. I went to the doctor. I'm going to go to the ER. She wants me to go into detox.
Mm-hmm.
And so I followed her in the hospital. She eventually ended up going to uni, so she eventually got some help, which I'm grateful for. Mm-hmm. But that's where my thought process had ended. It was like, all I want her to do is get help.
Right, right.
Period.
Yeah.
Okay. But I never thought about her and I in recovery, or in recovery together, and what that conversation looked like. Uh-huh. And it's a challenge. It really is.
Sure.
And you're in recovery groups and meetings all the time, and you talk about recovery with a stranger or with a friend, and you can engage back and forth and have meaningful conversations. When it's your child and they don't get it, and I'm being overly critical right now.
No, I yes, I understand that.
But there's dual roles here. I'm her mother, but I'm also in recovery.
Yes.
And there's a sub role here with someone who has been through recovery several times, and I have experience, and I do know what works for me. And I have to realize that this is her path, and she needs to go where it goes.
Yeah.
There's also the part of me that wants to slap the living crap out of her. So it's a challenge.
I sometimes feel that way every day at work. Just so.
And with every two-year-old child, you just want to put them in time out,
yes,
right?
Yes.
But she's not two.
No, definitely not.
So there are days like today where I just need to step back and let her do her thing.
Yeah, let her figure out that process. It's not your job.
Right? And then if she needs my help, I will be there.
Yeah.
In whatever role I can provide, and what I can't, and what's best for me in my recovery, that's where I'm at.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. Okay, we'll move on a little bit more now. So, with sort of that in, all of that in mind, one of the things that, you know, I like to explore, at least have some, I guess, you know, explore too, is this idea of, you know, sort of life lessons. You know, there are things in life that we learn, and there may be some moments that, whether it be, you know, there's a period where we become aware that we you know, see something or hear something or watch someone else go through something that becomes sort of inspiring to us in such a way that it becomes like a life lesson, like we take that moment. Do you remember anything like that as you've been going through life? And it could be something that happened in your childhood. It could be something, you know, through your, you know, early or late adolescence or early adulthood or something. Or it could be something that happened more recently that kind of stands out, sort of a lesson or a moment of understanding that came. And what that involved for you.
I have goosebumps.
Oh, okay.
And those goosebumps are more prevalent every day. I think those opportunities are available to us every single day if we are open to them. It was just yesterday. That I walked into the office and one of my coworkers shared with me a video, and I wasn't prepared for it at all. And it was his little nephew leaving Primary Children's Hospital on his last day of chemo. And I think he's 11 years old. And the staff had surrounded him and sang him a song and clapped about no more chemo. Mm. And this child has been through hell. And it brought me to tears. I mean, it was early in the morning, just walked in the office, and he wanted to share that with me. He had taken a phone call, so I walked away and had watched that. And that just brings me to gratitude, you know, how much I have to be grateful for. And I see that in nature. I see that in people. And I am reminded of those things so much in recovery and the beauty of children and my grandchildren and the thoughtfulness of strangers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily what somebody has said, but what I have witnessed. But I've never really truly experienced pure joy until I experienced true recovery. And that was when I went to Bryce Canyon and sobbed at the beautiful sight before me.
Mm.
I've seen it before,
mm-hmm.
and it never affected me that way.
I see.
But I entered the canyon and had to pull over and was beside myself.
Huh. You were seeing it or experiencing it through different eyes.
And yeah. I've done that several times.
Yeah.
And just thinking about it now just brings me to tears.
Brings goosebumps.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great example.
Yeah.
That's a great example.
Yeah.
Okay. What brings you the most joy in life?
Family. Being present. Reminded every day that I have the ability to be there for them. I think one thing I'm reminded of often is being able to be of, it's not necessarily service,
mm-hmm.
but it's one of the most special gifts that I've been given is to be able to be there for my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sometimes we wonder about our purpose, and I had to think of that while I was in Wasatch and wonder about what it was that was special about me, because when I first got there, I could think of nothing.
Oh my.
And you know
right.
yep. how, where you're at that point.
Not an uncommon feeling.
No, it's not. Mm-hmm. And trying to define yourself and who you are, it was always attached to something or someone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So being able to say that I am kind, I am loving, I am understanding, those things, I am able to be there for those boys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in their time of need, you know, maybe in that aspect when they need someone where while their mom is going through what they're going through, to be able to be there for them right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a gift.
Yeah.
For me.
Of course.
Yeah.
A beautiful gift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So grateful for that.
Okay. Yeah. So next is how do you connect to your Zen zone? How do you connect to that spot within in yourself or in life, and that sort of, you know, brings you a sense of meaning and purpose? And when I think of Zen zone, also I think beyond just purpose, I think of the place that centers us, you know,
mm-hmm.
the way we go. I mean, hearing your story about Bryce Canyon kind of gave me that same kind of feeling, as I get a lot of that from nature too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think about it also from a self-care. It's kind of what feeds me to get me to that place. And how about for you in your life? How do you find that?
I think it's mostly what feeds my senses in my serenity and my... I love being alone in those moments so that it can take me back to memories that... being very young.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking very young. I spoke to you about being able to go back and go fishing for the first time in recovery. It just hasn't come together. So I was able to go back and cast a line out into the reservoir and smell the wind off the reservoir and feel it through your hair and see the line
yes.
and see the sun glisten on the water and hear it lap up against the shore. And I can picture sitting on my grandpa's knee, you know, 2 years old. And I can get lost in the reverie for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The stars at night and the planets and the stories. And that stirs a creativity inside of me. I get lost in the art, and I can be there for hours just drawing, just with a pencil.
Beautiful.
And have no idea where it's going, but mm-hmm. come up with something unique.
Mm.
And look at pictures that I've taken in the past and get ideas for drawings of the future. But it just takes me places that, you know, in my abuse, it was behind a door. I knew it was there. I wanted to explore it, but it mm-hmm. never went anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's all these ideas and things and colors and space and time. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting. It's what tickles your belly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it brings you joy. It brings you peace. It brings all sorts of excitement for the future and especially in the moment.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Okay. How about this idea of faith and God and universe, and how do you find connection, and do you label it or define it as anything, as some people like to? How does that get represented in your life?
I don't label it. I know there's a lot of wonder inside of me about what's out there. I explore
the mysteries of the
universe the science part of it, and exploring and reading and learning and listening and being objective. And I don't care for organized religion at all. I think there's possibilities everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much being discovered on a daily basis. So I find it in everything. I mean, in nature especially.
Mm-hmm.
I know we came from somewhere. and science seems like a good place as any.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
But I know for me, spiritual, I believe in that goodness. If you whatever you put out comes sure. back to you, I believe in karma.
Okay,
I do.
The cause and effect.
Yes,
part of that.
Absolutely.
That there is some balancing force in the universe.
Okay. I do.
Okay. All right. One of the things I know that brings a lot of passion and in people's lives, and I've been thinking about this more since Anthony Bourdain passed away a few months ago. Now it seems maybe it was a month ago. I can't exactly remember, but from suicide. And but one of the things that fascinated me about his story and his what he did, which is why I kind of fell in love with his journey, was this idea of how food and travel and conversation brought him together to find commonality in people. And I see food as a very powerful medium in life. And I wonder if you have anything particularly that you said tickles your belly, but that's on the culinary aspects of life. Is there anything that strongly calls to you at times?
Well, I love to cook for people,
mm-hmm.
And I don't do it enough. I don't think we as a people get together like we used to. We as a people, we as a family, a people. We used to do it every Sunday.
Family's people, too.
Family's people. My people. My tribe. And I've we've definitely done it more often since I got out of recovery, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And I plan to do it more, but I love to cook. And I love to cook on my own. I love to experiment. I've always been what our family calls a mucker.
A mucker?
A mucker.
Okay.
I mean, I don't follow recipes. Yeah. We know what goes together. And,
right.
You know, I've talked about, you know, the...
The improvisational piece of this. Yeah, I know.
Yes.
I'm the same way. I love that whole idea of just exploring,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, I have some ideas of direction and flavors and textures, but, I don't...
We know what goes good together and what doesn't. That doesn't sound good. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've been baking, too.
Oh, cool.
One of the owner's wife... loves cheesecake, and so I said, would you like a cheesecake for your birthday? You would make me a cheesecake? I said, I would love to make you cheesecake.
That's great.
I have this amazing recipe for cheesecake, so I brought her a cheesecake. I never heard the end of it. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
So that's fun. I mean, gifting food is amazing.
Gifting
fun.
Food is gifting love.
Yes. Yeah. And I love to do that.
Yeah.
And there are neighbors that are kind to me that I gift food to, and that's baking and cooking is love to me, because that's art.
Yes.
And so to be able to gift art, mm-hmm. that's a part of yourself. And I love to do that with friends and family. And
beautifully said.
It opens yourself up to other people.
Beautifully said. Okay. Last thing we'll talk about today. I realize I didn't talk to you about it beforehand, but if you've listened to any others, you know I asked this question about music. If there are any songs in your life that have had some deep meaning to you personally, or a song, or if there was a life celebration for Lisa, what that would be, you know, if there's anything that you would want to have played. Do you have a song or two like that in life that you think are representational of you and your journey?
I think of many people when I hear this song, and especially my grandmother. And I often think, you know, maybe this song. And it's by Train. And it's called When I Look to the Sky.
I know the song.
Something tells me you're here with me.
And that really resonates with you because of the messaging of this idea.
Always being with
always,
me.
Always being connected.
Yes.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Okay. One other thing that I realized I thought maybe you could talk about just a little bit before we wrap up today is... In the book, I tell the schema story, right?
Oh my God!
Yes, and yes, you are that Lisa, by the way. So I believe
you're not going to believe this. I did it again.
Oh, you did! Oh my God, that's even better.
But I'm improving.
You are
so. In Paul's book, he talks about me in the very beginning. I can't believe you did that, but that's okay because I gave you permission, didn't I?
You did.
I did. So. In actually my darkest days of my addiction, because I really have better taste than Budweiser, but I had no choice. I go to the C-Store or the 7-Eleven on the corner and get a 30-pack of Budweiser because it was right there on the corner. And I did that a lot. And so in recovery... I've avoided that 7-Eleven and started going to the New Holiday Oil, which is right next door, across the street. So the 7-Eleven's on the northeast corner, the Holiday's on the northwest corner. Mm-hmm. So I stopped going to 7-Eleven. And then when my son and his sweet wife went on their honeymoon, they asked me to watch their little baby Gizmo.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I was out of Diet Pepsi, which is tragic, and so headed over to the Holiday Oil to get me a 12-pack of Diet Pepsi,
mm-hmm.
and had him on my lap, which is a little nervous for me because I hadn't had him with me like that before, and headed out of the garage and headed over to the Holiday Oil.
You want to explain who Gizmo is?
Oh, I'm
some
sorry.
People may be having a vision of you riding with a little toddler or something in your lap in the
car. I'm sorry.
I know who Gizmo is.
Yes, thank you. Gizmo is a little long-haired chihuahua. Yeah. I think he's 9 years old this year. Yeah. And my daughter-in-law's had Gizmo all his life, so... Yeah, he's my little grandson, so I had him on my lap and headed over to the Holiday Oil, told Gizmo to wait for me, and lo and behold, I'm standing in front of the beer cooler at 7-Eleven, not realizing how I got there.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
The power of schemas.
Yeah. And so last night, I headed over there to get me a 12-pack of Pepsi. Mm-hmm. I was in the turning lane to go to 7-Eleven again.
Oh, my goodness.
And I thought, I'm not going to let you do this to me. And so I went to Apollo Burger and got me hamburger.
Good intervention.
I know.
You changed that schema. All right. Yeah. What a perfect story. That is so great. I'm glad you had another experience with this. And how powerful schemas are, how they just run underneath without any awareness at all.
It's amazing, such a part, yes. You know, because people tell stories in the past of, I don't know what happened, but I ended up at the liquor store, and you call bullshit on that every time, it can happen.
It is, because it's an old running schema.
Yes.
That's been there for so long. It's why people repeat behaviors that they go, I don't know why. Why am I keep doing this? Mm-hmm. Well, it's so ingrained into us and become so much a part of our subconscious that we're just not aware of it. So the Lisa 7-Eleven or, you know, beer cooler stories are infamous now. So
at least I wake up before I do anything else. Right, it's like, see ya.
Well, but the schema is still there, kind of running sometimes. But your choice today is different.
Absolutely.
Because you don't pick up the 30-pack of Budweiser, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you.
I appreciate you spending a couple hours this afternoon with me and with us, our listeners.
It's been a pleasure.
And I know we've been wanting to get this done for a while. So
yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you all next week, or you'll hear us all next week. And we'll go out as we usually do with a little Joan Osborne. Thanks, guys.